Bob Moses, as you know, and thinks very highly of him. He feels that nobody else can carry on the parks or the highways or even the state hospitals except Moses, because he's got so much ability. Roosevelt was evasive, and in the days following the Executive Mansion Conference, Smith could see which way the wind was blowing. Roosevelt took pains to let reporters know that he had not had a single conference with Mrs. Moskowitz. He dodged their questions about Moses. Mrs. Moskowitz was, after all, more of a personal advisor to Smith than a state official. He did not again raise with Roosevelt the question of her reappointment. But Smith felt, as one observer recalls, that it would be a tragedy, a real tragedy, for the state to lose Moses' services as Secretary of State. There just wasn't anyone else with his ability around. Telephoning Roosevelt again, he asked for an appointment. Roosevelt was at Hyde Park, 60 miles from Albany, but, for Moses, Smith made a journey to Canosa. He was rewarded by an end to evasion. As soon as he had finished pleading with Roosevelt to reappoint Moses, the governor-elect leaned back, puffed on his cigarette for a moment, and then said flatly, "No, he rubs me the wrong way." It is significant that, although Moses held other state positions, the conversation between Smith and Roosevelt concerned only the Secretaryship of State. For the reasons why Moses' other positions were not discussed do much to pinpoint the sources of his power. Moses' six-year term as president of the Long Island State Park Commission did not expire until 1930, although Roosevelt was governor and the commission presidency was a gubernatorial appointment. Moses did not need Roosevelt's approval to remain in the post. The chairmanship of the State Parks Council was conferred not by the governor, but by the council. Moses did not need Roosevelt's approval to remain in that post either. The only way Roosevelt could remove Moses from either of his park posts was by bringing formal charges against him. But charges of what? If Moses had been guilty of impropriety or illegality, how was a governor supposed to know it? Moses kept the operation of the commission so secret that no outsider knew where to start looking for proof, or could guess whether, if he did look, he would find any. A governor could, of course, launch a full-scale investigation into the commission, but this would involve the gravest political risks, since public opinion was firmly behind Moses. And what if the investigation did not find anything? Then it would look like a malicious attempt to defame a great man. An attempt could be made to defeat Moses at the next State Parks Council election, but his careful stacking of the council membership had made that very difficult. The governor could, of course, change the membership, but only gradually, since the members' terms were also 6 years. And if word of a council-packing attempt got out, public opinion would again ride with Moses. Parks were supposed to be free from politics. As he had done in the little world of Yale, Robert Moses had erected within New York State a power structure all his own, an agency ostensibly part of the state government, but only minimally responsive to its wishes. The structure might appear flimsy, but it was shored up with buttresses of the strongest material available in the world of politics, public opinion. A governor, even a governor who hated the man who dwelt within that structure, would pull it down at his own peril. Moses understood this. Asked 40 years later why Roosevelt did not oust him from his park posts, he would laugh and say, "He couldn't afford to. The public wouldn't have stood for it. And even if he tried to, it would have been very difficult. See, the law didn't permit it except on charges. It was set up that way, see? That's the way it was set up." This explanation came at the end of a 4-hour interview. All during it, Moses had been serious and guarded in his statements. But when he said this, he suddenly threw back his head and laughed, a laugh of pure enjoyment. "That," he said, still laughing, "was the way it was set up, don't you see?" Roosevelt apparently saw. Moses pushed matters to a head himself. The duties of Secretary of State included the organization of the inaugural ceremonies. It was the Secretary, in fact, who would administer the oath of office to the new governor, and Moses had to confer with Roosevelt about the arrangements. At the end of one conference, he raised the subject of his reappointment, and when Roosevelt dodged, Moses demanded, "You don't want me to stay on, do you?" Whatever Roosevelt's exact reply was, he made it clear that Moses' assumption was not incorrect. But the governor-elect had then to make it clear that he was talking only about the secretaryship. He had to ask Moses hastily to stay on his park jobs. Revenge could not have been nearly as sweet as he had hoped. The aftermath of the conversation must have made it positively sour. Stalking out of Roosevelt's office, Moses immediately composed a curt letter saying that he would resign as Secretary of State when Governor Smith leaves Albany. Then he released it to the press, embarrassing Roosevelt, who had no successor ready to announce. Moses, moreover, included in the letter a paragraph saying, "In accordance with our understanding, I shall carry on the state park work," and a flood of editorials greeted this statement with relief. "It is gratifying," said the World. "Gratifying," chimed in the Times. And Roosevelt, in a hastily composed one-paragraph reply to the resignation letter, had to express gratification too, saying, "I am, of course, very happy that you will continue to carry on the work. You have rendered conspicuous service, and I can assure you that I shall often avail myself of your continued cooperation." The identity of the replacements for Moses and Mrs. Moskowitz could not have been more insulting to Al Smith if Roosevelt had selected them with that aim in mind. As his personal secretary, he chose Guernsey Cross, whose sole qualification was that he was big and strong enough for the governor to lean on when he walked. As Secretary of State, he chose the boss of the Bronx, Edward J. Flynn, whose experience in government, as distinguished from politics, was non-existent, and who didn't even want the job and would not agree to take it until Roosevelt, after Moses resigned, frantically pursued him on a trip around Europe by transatlantic telephone calls and cables. "The basic reason for my appointment," Flynn later wrote, "was that Roosevelt did not want to appoint Moses." Flynn's lack of experience in government forced Roosevelt to downgrade the secretaryship, reducing it mainly to its licensing and ceremonial functions. Flynn never devoted much time to it, and it was never again to be a sort of deputy governorship, or in fact, of any real importance in the state governmental setup. What made Roosevelt's refusal to reappoint Moses all the more bitter to Smith was that the new governor, anxious to avoid any appearance of an open break with his immensely popular predecessor, reappointed 16 of the 18 members of Smith's cabinet, every one except Moses, the only one Smith had asked him to reappoint, and the state industrial commissioner, a minor official whose dismissal Smith intimates interpreted as a throw-in so that newspapers would not be able to comment that Moses had been the only one thrown out. At the inauguration, however, Smith and Roosevelt put on a show of harmony. When Franklin and Eleanor moved into the executive mansion on December 31st, Al, who had returned to the mansion for the occasion, met them at the door and, as reporters crowded close to listen, said, "A thousand welcomes. We've got the home fires burning, and you'll find this is a fine place to live." Roosevelt, turning to the reporters, said, "I only wish Al were going to be right here for the next 2 years." One reporter, watching Al depart, waving his brown derby as the crowd sang Auld Lang Syne, wrote that Roosevelt was wearing a smile that had a trace of wistfulness. The next day, at the official inauguration ceremony, the charade continued. In a brief valedictory, Smith praised Roosevelt to the crowd that jammed the assembly chamber. Only Moses would not put on a show. When Roosevelt stood up to take the oath, Moses realized for the first time just how weak his legs were. "The platform was high above the ground," he told the author, "and people couldn't see what was going on, but both his legs had to be locked upright, the hinges squeaking and then snapping into place." But that didn't stop Moses from doing what he had planned. When Roosevelt made his way to the lectern, one arm gripping a cane, the other the arm of his eldest son, James, and placed his hand on the family's 200-year-old Dutch Bible, Moses administered the oath of office, and, as soon as it was finished, without waiting for Roosevelt's inaugural address, stalked off the platform and out of the chamber. Chapter 17. The Mother of Accommodation. Now Robert Moses no longer had behind him a governor of whose unquestioning loyalty he could, right or wrong, always be certain. Executive support, about which he had not had to worry for 10 years, was a source of concern again. And within 3 months after Roosevelt had succeeded Smith, Moses was to be reminded how much difference this could mean to him. The great piece of his business left unstarted at the close of Smith's regime was the Northern State Parkway. In the North Hills, the name given to the terminal moraine near the New York City line, Moses had found a line of small farms that could make a right-of-way, twisting, turning, but still a right-of-way between the holdings of the North Hill barons. Where there was not the slightest crevice between estates, he had introduced into the parkway's route still more curves, so that it would run along the very edges of the barons' estates and not disturb the serenity of their manor houses. He had threaded the route along that portion of the rough at the Lynx Country Club that could most easily be spared without spoiling the barons' favorite golf course. And by paying them tribute in the form of private bridges and personal entrances, he had persuaded them to donate the right-of-way he needed. The barons of the Dix Hills in the western portion of Suffolk County, Otto Kahn, Stimson, Mills, Winthrop, and DeForest, had thrown back with contemptuous ease his attempt to penetrate the fastnesses they controlled, but Kahn's $10,000 had enabled him to snatch from James Roth and other meek farmers of the plains to the south 13 more miles of right-of-way. But between the North Hills and Dix Hills stood the Wheatley Hills, the meeting place of the two moraines, the bolt of the scissors that made Long Island beautiful. And in the Wheatley Hills, the estates, identified by black and gold signs bearing such names as Morgan, Whitney, Winthrop, Grace, Garvin, and Phipps, clustered around the little village of Old Westbury so thickly that there was no path, no matter how tortuous, that could be picked out without running through their holdings. These barons therefore refused to parley, and instead hired champions to fight Moses. And the champions included Grenville Clark, whose brilliance as an attorney was not at all dimmed in their eyes by the fact that he had been a Harvard classmate of Franklin D. Roosevelt. Even before Roosevelt's inauguration, Clark was writing to him at Warm Springs, suggesting an alternate route, with a sharp southward dip just before it got to Old Westbury, so that it avoided the Wheatley Hills completely. Dashing off his own letter to Warm Springs, Moses told Roosevelt that Clark was trying to change the location of about 6 miles of right-of-way in the center of the parkway for the sole purpose of avoiding a few people whom he represents. This, Moses said, would involve torturing the parkway down toward the middle of the island where the landscaping problem is almost insuperable. He would never agree to do so. To brace up Roosevelt, he added that the Wheatley Hills barons are people of large wealth who have always been able to buy what they wanted or to get what they wanted by influence and pressure. It is difficult for these people to believe there is anyone they cannot reach in some way. For several months, Moses seemed to be winning the fight. Roosevelt drove over the two routes himself and wrote Clark that he saw no reason to change Moses' plans. But those plans were soon to be changed nonetheless. For Grenville Clark discovered how Otto Kahn, Moses' relative, had persuaded Moses to shift the parkway route off his private golf course. Clark relayed the discovery to Hutchinson and Hewitt. The two legislative leaders telegraphed Moses demanding a complete list of all properties, payment for which has been made or is intended to be made by funds from private sources for any parkway or proposed parkway, and a complete list of persons who have given funds to the Long Island Parkway, SICK, Commission. And the telegram demanded, please also state whether the route of any proposed parkway was ever tentatively laid out over, through, or near the land of any donors of money, If so, after receipt of such gift, was route of any proposed parkway changed so as to run over or through a different part of the land of any donor or donors, or so as not to run at all through or near such land? At first, Moses was defiant. Hastily sending an explanation to Roosevelt, he admitted that Kahn had given $10,000, but said that the idea that we shifted our route to please one man because he gave us some money is too absurd to entertain. The real reason for the shift, he said, was the objection of Stimson to Forrest and various others to the routing of the parkway across their land and their refusal to donate land unless the route was shifted south, a statement which conveniently ignored the fact that if the route hadn't been shifted off Kahn's land in the first place, it would never have touched their land and their donations would not have been needed. At first, Moses' new executive gave him support, backing the Wheatley Hills route. But Clark began hinting that any attempt to push that route would result in the disclosure to the public of the Moses-Kahn deal, which, he said, if finally brought to light, will not make a creditable chapter in the history of this state. Various attempts at compromise failed, and Clark and Hewitt and Hutchinson made clear to Roosevelt that any attempt to obtain legislative appropriations for the Northern State Parkway until its route had been shifted out of the Wheatley Hills would result in an all-out fight. The fight over the Taylor Estate, now to be named Hexter State Park, had been an all-out one, of course, but there would be a significant difference this time. The issue in the first case had been that of millionaires blocking the public. In the Northern State Parkway case, it would be that of a millionaire giving $10,000 to keep his private golf course untouched and the money being used to throw hard-working farmers off their land. It was not the type of issue likely to redound to the credit of the official who had accepted the $10,000 and thrown the farmers off their land, or of a governor who was placed in the position of defending his action. Whether Roosevelt was motivated by the threat of public disclosure to prevail on Moses to compromise is not definitely known. But the following sequence of events is clear. On October 23, 1929, Clark gave Roosevelt what amounted to an ultimatum. He and his clients had decided, he said, that it was impossible to reach any kind of agreement with Moses because he refused to compromise and was highly insulting, and that a full-scale fight would be launched during the 1930 legislative session. 1930 was an election year. Among those running for re-election would be Franklin D. Roosevelt. Less than 2 weeks after Clark issued the Barron's ultimatum to Roosevelt, Moses agreed to a compromise. Under the compromise, the northern state suddenly altered its eastward course at Glen Cove Road, the western border of the Wheatley Hills, just as it was about to plunge into the estate area, and instead swung south for 2 full miles, far enough so that when it resumed its course, it would never come near the Wheatley Hills. To make it appear that the compromise was really a compromise, and that both sides, instead of just the state, had given in, Moses announced to the public with great fanfare that the barons had agreed to pay the state $175,000, which he said would pay for the entire cost of the detour. Actually, however, the cost of the additional right-of-way alone would be $2,250,000, so that more than 90% of the bill for the accommodation Moses reached with the barons had to be footed by the state's taxpayers. The long-term costs to the public of Moses' accommodation include figures that cannot be prefaced with dollar signs. For one thing, the accommodation condemned users of the parkway to a perpetual detour of 5 miles around the Wheatley Hills. Coupled with the 6-mile detour forced on parkway users by Moses' previous accommodation with Otto Kahn and the other Dix Hill barons, it meant that a commuter who lived anywhere east of Dix Hills and who used the parkway to get to his job in New York City was condemned to drive, every working day of his life, 22 extra and unnecessary miles. He had to drive 110 unnecessary miles per week, 5,500 per year, all because of Moses' compromise. By the 1960s, there were about 21,500 such commuters, and the cost to them alone of Moses' accommodation totaled tens of millions of wasted hours of human lives. More important, Moses' great accommodation deprived the public forever of parks in the loveliest part of Long Island. He had once wanted parks on the wooded hills of the North Shore, and his original concept of the Northern State Parkway was therefore of a road leading to parks, as the Southern State Parkway led to parks. But as part of his compromise, he had to promise the barons that there would not be a single state park anywhere along the parkway, or anywhere in the section of the North Shore that they controlled, and with a single exception, acquired in 1967 and still undeveloped in 1974, there are no state parks anywhere in that part of Nassau County or western Suffolk that was known as the North Shore or the Gold Coast. Robert Moses' compromise with the North Shore barons amounted to unconditional surrender. In later years, most of the barons would have disappeared from the Long Island scene. The names of most of them would be unfamiliar to the new generations using the Northern State Parkway. But every twist and curve in that parkway, and in particular the two great southward detours it makes around the Wheatley and Dix Hills, is a tribute to their power and to the use to which they put it after they discovered the chink in Moses' armor. Farmer James Roth was not the only person who paid for Moses' deal with Otto Kahn. The completeness of Moses' surrender, coupled with the fact that Moses never surrendered on any park or parkway issue while Smith was governor, makes it difficult to escape the conclusion that the change in governors had something to do with it. By accepting Otto Kahn's $10,000, Moses had presented his opponents with a weapon which they used to club him and New York State into submission. But by illegally appropriating the Taylor estate, he had presented many of the same opponents in that battle with an equally dangerous weapon. And somehow, Al Smith had avoided its swings and beaten them into the ground. Fighting under the Squire of the Hudson was not precisely the same as fighting under the King of Oliver Street. There were other differences. In Albany, where a legislative session is round after round of hastily formed alliances, trust in a man's word is all important. When a man promised his support on a bill, he could not later take it back. If he did so, the word on him would soon begin to circulate through the corridors of the Capitol, and when discussing their relationships with him, legislators would say, "We deal in writing," a phrase which, in Albany, was the ultimate insult. Al Smith could say, "When I give my word, it sticks." Now, in the corridors of the Capitol, many men were saying of the new governor, "We deal in writing." Diminutive Reuben Lazarus, the one-time legislative page boy who had since become one of the Capitol's most knowledgeable bill drafters, good enough to be New York City's legislative representative, believed that he had been misled twice within a month by Roosevelt when he asked the governor his intention on bills important to Tammany Hall and told Roosevelt to his face, "Governor, from now on we deal in writing, and I'm going to demand a bond on your signature." No man had more bills awaiting signature than Robert Moses, and Roosevelt seemed to take special delight in misleading him. Once Lazarus was sitting in the anteroom outside the governor's office, and I heard Moses inside shout, "Frank Roosevelt, you're a goddamned liar, and this time I can prove it. I had a stenographer present." And Moses came storming out of FDR's office without even seeing me. He was so thoroughly angry. I was next, and I walked in. The governor's face was breaking into a grin of real pleasure. He acted as though he had just come out of a bath after a clean shave in the morning. After several such incidents, Moses developed a new routine for his trips to Albany. He would arrive early in the morning for conferences with Roosevelt at the Executive Mansion, but even though the governor might promise that a bill then on his desk for his signature would be signed, Moses would not leave the Capitol until it was. But if Roosevelt gave Moses a hard time before doing so, he did nonetheless sign most of Moses' bills. And although he may have hated Moses, during the 4 years of his governorship, he gradually increased, not decreased, Moses' power. He did so, moreover, despite the fact that Moses never trimmed his sails in their personal relationship. He never called Roosevelt governor, and he made a point of not doing so, not only in private letters, but also in official correspondence. It was always, "Dear Frank." He refused to follow conventional lines in their official relations either. Although his State Parks Council was a part of Roosevelt's administration, the council adopted major new policies without conferring with the governor about them, sometimes even without notifying the governor about them. Once, when Moses had the council pass a resolution asking the legislature to remove all historical state reservations from the council's control and turn them over to the Department of Education, the governor was reduced to begging Henry Lutz, "Will you be good enough to let me know whether the report is true?" Moses may have obeyed Al Smith's patronage suggestions without question, but he wouldn't even listen to Roosevelt's. As Jones Beach and other state parks opened during Roosevelt's regime, the number of jobs at Moses' disposal steadily increased. By 1930, the number of lifeguards, special police, gardeners, parking field and bathhouse attendants, janitors, and toll takers at the Long Island parks was more than 1,500. Long Island Democrats eyed these jobs greedily and expectantly, since Moses was a subordinate of a Democratic governor. After they had asked Moses for some jobs and had been refused, they appealed to Roosevelt to order him to make some available. Roosevelt gingerly suggested to Moses that he cooperate, and Moses curtly refused. The governor's personal requests received the same treatment. Roosevelt sent on to Moses a job application with a notation attached, "Dear Bob, this is an old school boyfriend of mine, and I would be very glad if you could help him in some way." Moses replied by simply sending the governor a copy of the official employment regulations of the commission, which included the sentence, "Recommendations based upon merely personal or political acquaintance will not be considered." And the explanation for the increase in Moses' power during Roosevelt's governorship certainly wasn't that he gave in like a good subordinate if he had a difference of opinion with his chief over a matter of policy. In fact, if his powers of persuasion were not sufficient to persuade Roosevelt to alter what Moses felt was an unwise decision, he did not hesitate to mobilize forces against the governor. For years, Roosevelt, naval buff and lover of the sea, had wanted to transform Fort Schuyler, a little-used 56-acre army base at Prague's Neck in the Bronx, into a merchant marine academy. The folding chairs set up on the assembly speaker's dais for his inauguration had hardly been stored away when he began prodding the army to close the base and turn the land over to the state. In 1931, the army finally agreed, but no sooner had it done so than Moses announced that Fort Schuyler should be turned into a park instead. When the governor refused even to consider that suggestion, Fort Schuyler, he said, was going to be a merchant marine academy, the matter was closed, Moses mobilized his forces. The Park Association of New York City met to formally endorse Moses' suggestion. So did the Washington Heights Taxpayers Association, the Public Schools Athletic League, 25 other civic organizations, of a total membership of 500,000, organized into a committee to back the park plea, and the Sulzberger's Times. The influentials who made up the Park Association's board of directors took the trouble to write personally to Roosevelt on the issue. After conferring with Moses, Nathan Strauss Jr., association president, said, "If it's made an academy, it will train 300 or 400 boys. If it's made a park, 300,000 to 400,000 people will use it every summer weekend." Apparently, Roosevelt did not realize for some time that it was actually Moses who was behind the opposition. As late as January 8, 1932, Guernsey Cross, obviously under the impression that Moses was on the governor's side, wrote to ask him for a suggested reply that the governor could make to a letter from George F. Mand, president of the Bronx Chamber of Commerce. Moses replied promptly. Attached is suggested reply to Mand. "Dear Dr. Mand, I agree with you that it is much more important to use this area for municipal recreation purposes than to make it the headquarters for the U.S. Merchant Marine Academy, which can well be taken care of with a smaller and cheaper piece of land outside the city limits. Cross hurriedly asked Conservation Commissioner Henry Morgenthau to draft the reply instead. Even after he realized Moses' involvement, however, there was nothing Roosevelt could do. When Samuel Rosenman and Herbert Lehman, contacted by reform leaders, both asked him to forget about the academy, he must have realized that he was surrounded, and he surrendered. He was able to realize this pet project only after he had been elected president. On December 29, 1932, 2 days before his term as governor ended, he signed, on behalf of New York State, a lease proffered by the War Department giving the land to the state for a New York Merchant Marine Academy. And even at this date, Roosevelt did not make any public announcement of the transaction, so that the public did not learn what he had done until he was no longer governor. Part of the explanation for Moses' increased power was simply the breadth and depth of his knowledge of the government at whose head Roosevelt, with little preparation, suddenly had found himself. No one knew the vast administrative machinery the governor was supposed to run better than this man the governor hated. To a considerable extent, the machinery was his machinery. He, more than any other individual, had drafted the executive budget system, the departmental consolidation, and the hundreds of bills that implemented those constitutional amendments. He, more than any other individual, knew the considerations, constitutional, legal, and political, that lay behind wording in those laws that was otherwise so puzzling. He knew the precedents that made each point in them legal, and the precedents that might call their legality into question. He knew the reason behind every refinement, every clarification, and every obscuration in the law's final versions. When discussing a point of law with some young state agency counsel, Moses liked to let the lawyer painstakingly explain the legal ramifications involved, and then say dryly, "I know. I wrote the law." This store of knowledge, coupled with an intelligence capable of drawing upon it with computer-like rapidity, constituted a political weapon which no governor could afford to let rust in his arsenal. Roosevelt's very first major administrative hurdle, the compilation of his first budget, taught him Moses' indispensability. The 1929 budget would be the first drawn up under the executive budget system Moses had codified. But no sooner had Roosevelt presented it to the Republican legislature, a 411-page complete plan of proposed expenditures and estimated revenues, then the legislator struck at its heart, tacking onto the appropriation bills a rider that would give the chairman of its finance committees, Hewitt and Hutchinson, an equal say with the governor in determining how each department should spend the lump sums proposed for it by the governor. The rider was the last desperate challenge of men who saw their power being stripped from them, and they didn't spare the invective. A Syracuse assemblyman, referring to Roosevelt as "that man downstairs," trumpeted that "the very foundation of the state is in danger with this message of avarice, usurpation, and presumption." Roosevelt was unsure how to deal with the challenge. So were his legal advisors, some of whom told him to avoid a test on the issue in the courts, since a decision could go either way, and since, while it was being decided, all state expenditures might be paralyzed. The new governor's initial inclination was to sign the bills, distasteful though their rider may have been. When, however, he asked Moses' opinion, he was told to veto the bills. The courts, Moses said, would hold that the governor's budget was constitutional and the legislature's unconstitutional, and it was perfectly possible to work out a method for financing state activities while the courts were deliberating. Roosevelt sent his former law partner, Basil O'Connor, to see George Wickersham, the reformer and ex-United States Attorney General, and Wickersham said Moses was right. As Roosevelt drafted a veto message, he found himself asking Moses for suggestions. Moses gave them, and the message as delivered to the legislature was substantially the one Moses wrote. When lawyers began to draft the governor's brief, they found themselves relying more and more on Moses for background information. Then they realized they were relying on him for strategy. On November 19, 1929, the seven members of the state's highest court, the Court of Appeals, held unanimously, as Moses had predicted they would, that the legislature's action was unconstitutional. The principle of executive and legislative separation was at last irrevocably established in New York State, and Roosevelt had learned the truth of a saying of Al Smith's, "If Bob Moses says it's constitutional, it's constitutional." And then there was Moses' record of accomplishment and his potential for more accomplishments, the fact that Moses had gotten things done and could get things done again. Moses' cleverness in writing laws, cementing himself in power, helped explain Roosevelt's initial decision not to try to take that power away. But a large part of the explanation for Roosevelt's subsequent willingness to increase Moses' power was not cleverness, but accomplishment, the record of what Moses had done with the power he had given himself. For the accomplishment and the potential for more accomplishment had very strong political connotations indeed. The program for which Moses had so frantically shoveled sod under Smith came to full bloom in the first of Roosevelt's gubernatorial summers. The summer of 1929 was the summer of the Hoover Market. It was the summer of General Motors, radio, and big steel, of AT&T, of General Electric, which would by Labor Day hit $3.06, having more than tripled its price in 18 months. The summer of 1929 was the summer of Big Bill Tilden, who won his seventh American Amateur Tennis Championship, of Bobby Jones and his putter, Calamity Jane, who together carried off the U.S. Open Golf Championship, of Ernest Hemingway's Farewell to Arms, and of Thomas Wolfe, whose first novel, Look Homeward Angel, was uncrated at the bookstores in June. It was the summer of Kate Smith, who began in those golden months her career as a radio songstress, and of Gertrude Berg, who in those months first shouted, "Yoo-hoo!" across a Bronx air shaft. And the summer of 1929 was the summer of Robert Moses. Heckscher State Park was formally opened in June, and the onlooker who shouted, "God bless him!" when Moses was introduced was only sounding the first note of the chorus of hosannas the summer was to bring. "You owe this park to the amazing public spirit of Robert Moses," August Heckscher told 15,000 cheering onlookers, and Lieutenant Governor Lehman, praising Moses for his vision and courage, agreed. The Southern State Parkway was opened in July, and fathers driving their families along the lovely tree-shaded road, which, with the width of 40 feet, seemed wonderfully wide, were explaining to their wives what no-grade crossings meant, and telling their children as they passed Wantagh that by the end of the summer they would be able to take another parkway there and drive down to the ocean and swim, and every newspaper story on the southern state coupled its marvels with the name of its creator. And when, on August 4, 1929, the Wantagh Causeway opened the way to Jones Beach, the hosannas became a hallelujah chorus. On the day the causeway opened, 25,000 cars rolled across it. In the first month of its operation, attendance at Jones Beach State Park, which legislators had said would never justify its investment because people would never drive 40 miles to a park on a sandbar, topped 325,000. The press, not only New York's press, but the press of the entire country, spoke of the expanses of surf and sand in tones of awe. Reporters vied with one another in searching for superlatives to describe the parking areas that one said look as big as a cattle range, and bathhouses such as you have never seen before. The praise wasn't only for the size of the park's buildings, it was for the taste with which they had been designed, and the ingenuity with which there had been worked into their steel and stone delicate details which the eye, to its delight, was endlessly discovering. Visitors could see that the nautical theme had been carried out everywhere. Walking along the mile-long boardwalk connecting the two bathhouses, they noticed that the boardwalk railing was a ship's railing. Bending down to drink from a water fountain, they found that the fountains were turned on and off by ship's pilot wheels. Looking for trash cans, they found them concealed in ship's funnels. Looking up, visitors saw on the flagpoles crow's nests and yard arms and halyards decorated with long rows of bright semaphore signals. They saw ship's lanterns swinging on davits from the lampposts. Looking down, expecting the paved walks in the park to be standard gray concrete, they were surprised by mosaics of compasses, maps, and the gay seahorse that Moses had chosen as the emblem of Jones Beach set into the concrete. The games along the boardwalk were ship's games, shuffleboard, quoits, deck tennis, ping pong. Even the pitch-and-putt golf course was made maritime by the placing near every hole of some reminder of the sea, a rusty anchor, the keel of an ancient boat, old rum kegs retrieved from the Great South Bay. All Jones Beach employees were garbed as sailors, complete with sailor caps, and their supervisors wore officers' uniforms, complete with gold braid. And every button on the uniforms was engraved with a seahorse. Architects exclaimed over the long, low, sweeping lines of the bathhouses and restaurants, their medieval and Moorish cast, the combination of Ohio sandstone and Barbizon brick. Perfect, exulted one architect. Perfect, with which they were faced. They were startled when, searching for the water tower, they realized that it was concealed in the 200-foot-high campanile. They described with delight the diaper-changing rooms, the cutouts of bowmen crouching against the dune that formed the backdrop for the archery range, the symbolic ironwork cutouts on the directional signs, the gay devices of stone and brick, all the touches that Robert Moses, standing alone on a deserted sandbar, had decided he must have in his great park. It is in the smaller things that Mr. Moses is at his very best, Architectural Forum was to say. Usually a public institution of any kind in this country has been the occasion for especially dull architecture and walls of cheerless dimensions, which invite only the scribbling of small obscenities. But Mr. Moses, being essentially a romanticist, has revived the handicraft spirit in his designers, with the result that the equipment at Jones Beach exhibits irrelevant and endearing good spirits. The architecture has the great virtue of being scaled down to the size of a good time. Even the Herald Tribune could only wax rhapsodic over this most prosaically named, most beautifully landscaped of beaches. And the letters on the editorial page almost outdid the editorials. Ernest Beale of Manhattan, just back from a cross-country trip, hastened to take pen in hand to inform his fellow Times readers, "I have visited nearly all of the important beach resorts in this country, and I must say that nowhere on this continent is there a public or private beach that is even comparable to the one that the state under Robert Moses has built." A thousand letters to the editor echoed Beale's appraisal. A nation looked at Robert Moses' dream and found it good. And not just the nation. Delegations of architects and park designers came from France, from England, even from Scandinavia, traditional leader in park development, to learn from Jones Beach. Their comments were summed up by one Englishman, who said flatly, "This is the finest seashore playground ever given the public anywhere in the world." Never, observers agreed, had any park been kept as clean as Jones Beach. College students hired for the summer were formed into courtesy squads. Patrolling the boardwalk, conspicuous in snow-white sailor suits and caps, they hurried to pick up dropped papers and cigarette butts while the droppers were still in the vicinity. They never reprimanded the culprits, but simply bent down, picked up the litter, and put it in a trash basket. To make the resultant embarrassment of the litterers more acute, Moses refused to let the courtesy squatters use sharp-pointed sticks to pick up litter without stooping. He wanted the earnest, clean-cut college boys stooping, Moses explained to his aides. It would make the litterers more ashamed. He even issued the courtesy squatters large cloths so that they could wipe from the boardwalk gobs of spittle. His methods worked. As one writer put it, "You will feel like a heel if you so much as drop a gum wrapper." The lines of wire trash receptacles on the clean white sand were only a symbol of the emphasis on cleanliness there also. At intervals, loudspeakers sounded a bugle call, and then an announcer, in a carefully modulated tone, thanked the visitors for their cooperation in keeping the beach clean. The effect, as one observer wrote, is magical. In no time at all, every guilty culprit is doing KP in his immediate area. Moses' methods extended to his parkways. Stetsoned state troopers stopped every car entering them and gave the driver a card printed with Rules of the Road, which carefully spelled out rules against roadside picnicking and littering. And the rules were enforced. Littering summonses were issued wholesale. Occasionally, when troopers came across a whole bag of garbage that had been tossed from an automobile window, they would try to identify the driver from the contents. If they could, they would call on him at his home to issue a summons, and Moses would see that there was a troop of newspaper photographers along to record the culprit's expression when he opened his door. The public praised also the success with which Moses had kept Jones Beach free of the usual amusement park trappings of other public beaches. "There are no concessions, no booths, no bawling hot dog vendors," marveled one writer. "You won't see any weight guessers or three throws for a dime and win a dolly alleys or blaring funhouses. For almost the first time in the history of public beaches, this beach is conceived as a spot for recreation, not amusement stimulated by honky-tonk." Whenever Jones Beach was the subject of a magazine article, it seemed, and it was the subject of literally scores in the 1930s, the article contained, at least once, the word wholesome. The public beat a path to Moses' door. In 1930, the attendance at Jones Beach would be 1,500,000. In 1931, 2,700,000. In 1932, 3,200,000. The path itself, so recently completed, was jammed to capacity, and then to overcapacity. Although all grade crossings had been eliminated on the southern state, two, one at Sunrise Highway and one at Merrick Road, remained on the Wantagh because of the refusal of the legislature to allocate money for the bridges that would carry the two crossroads over the causeway. For the same reason, there was a half-mile gap between the southern state and the Wantagh. By 1930, traffic was backing up at those spots for more than a mile on summer Sundays. In 1931, the legislature allocated funds for the bridges and a spur between the two roads. Moses was jubilant. "The traffic capacity of the causeway will be more than doubled," he said. The facilities at Jones Beach proved inadequate. Both bathhouses were usually filled by noon. The parking lots, as big as cattle ranges, were jammed as full as sardine tins. Valley Stream, Hexter, and Sunken Meadow State Parks were just as crowded. Moses revealed more of the plans he had kept secret and enlarged them. "There should be an increase in facilities, bathhouses, parking fields, and concessions, at all state parks on Long Island," he said. "There should be a short parkway," he named it the Hexter Spur, linking the southern state with Hexter State Park, "and a Sunken Meadow State Parkway, linking the northern state with Sunken Meadow State Park." During the fall of 1930, the two-mile-long Ocean Parkway, extending along the barrier beach from Jones Beach eastward toward Fire Island, was opened. When he had asked the legislature for money for the parkway, Moses had said that 2 miles of an ocean drive was all he had in mind. Now he revealed that he actually had been concealing a few other miles, 98 to be precise. "Why," he demanded, "shouldn't there be a continuous road bordered by the rolling Atlantic all the way from Breezy Point on the Rockaway Peninsula in New York City to Montauk Point at the tip of Long Island, a distance of 100 miles? It would not be difficult to create an ocean parkway through the Rockaways and Long Beach by widening existing streets and turning them into an ocean drive," he said. "The gap between these two beaches could easily be bridged. So could the gap between Long Beach and the Jones Beach portion of the Strand. In fact, he had already broached to Hempstead Town, to G. Wilbur Doughty and Tom McQuinney, to be precise, the possibility of Hempstead's building that bridge, and Hempstead seemed amenable. Hempstead should have been amenable, some indications of the size of the political boodle involved in such a construction job may be garnered by the fact that one of the contractors involved secured the job by paying $75,000 in cash to the Nassau County Republican Organization, and, just to ensure against any criticism, another $75,000 to the county's Democratic Organization. Thanks to the deeds of land on the Jones Beach portion of the Strand that he had accepted from Oyster Bay, wheedled from Hempstead, and politically blackmailed from Babylon, the Long Island Park Commission had already in hand the rights of way for the parkway along most of this 11-mile portion, which was called, in order eastward from Jones Beach State Park, High Hill Beach, Tobey Beach, Gilgo, Cedar Island Beach, Oak Beach, and Captree. At Captree, a causeway would jump a narrow inlet, and the ocean parkway would be on Fire Island. There, for 50 miles, it could run along the sand, the ocean stretching broad on one side, the bay beautiful on the other, until the barrier beach swung back at Mauritius to join the southern fluke of the whale's tail that was Long Island's eastern end. By pointing out to them that the building of a road along Fire Island would make their land immensely more valuable, he had, he disclosed, already persuaded 67 of the 70 property owners on Fire Island whose lands would be traversed by the parkway to donate the right of way. And although two of the three laggards, immensely wealthy and immensely stubborn spinster sisters named Smith, owned so much of the land needed that no public body could afford to condemn it, he was confident that they would sign up shortly. When the legislature balked, he pointed out that the land deeded to the state by the townships was worth millions of dollars. Did the legislators propose to let it go to waste? The legislators may have considered doing so, but in 1930, the public applause for the 2 miles of Ocean Parkway already opened made it obvious that such a course would be unwise. During the 1931 legislative session, money was appropriated to extend the road 8 miles farther through High Hill, Tobey, and Gilgo beaches. The Fire Island portion of the plan had to be dropped when the Smith sisters, for undisclosed reasons, refused to donate. But Moses came up with a substitute plan extending the Ocean Parkway all the way along the Jones Beach portion of the barrier beach to Captree, and then bringing it back to the mainland on a causeway and linking it up to the Southern State Parkway with a spur parkway. There would be time to get to Fire Island later. Editorials hailed each new Moses plan. The best proof of the universality of their appeal was furnished by Long Island, which for so long had resisted them. At the opening of Hexter State Park, two shy little girls had been ushered onto the porch of the Taylor Mansion to present Moses with a silver loving cup donated by the East Islip Community Association, a group that had been among the most vocal of W. Kingsland Macy's supporters in Macy's battle against the park. The presentation was symbolic. Long Island's real estate men adored Moses for opening the island to development and thus further inflating its already ballooning land values. Long Island's people had realized that they had the easiest access to the beaches he had created. A 1930 referendum in Islip Township, stronghold of the baymen and farmers, on a proposition to deed the Long Island State Park Commission land on Captree to facilitate the building of the Captree Causeway, passed by a margin of more than 3-1. Long Island politicians, fully aware now of the financial benefits that would accrue to them from Moses' plans, saw the political benefits too. Immediately following the referendum, both Nassau and Suffolk County boards of supervisors spent millions condemning right-of-way for Moses' proposed parkways and presented it to him as a gift. No governor would want to be placed in the position of opposing so immensely popular a program, or its creator. Financing Moses' projects placed an immense strain on the state budget. In 1929, with only those announced under Smith underway, their construction, including money spent on them out of the Public Works Department budget, cost the state $5,424,750, more than 70% of the entire state expenditure on construction projects in the metropolitan region, including Westchester County. And as the parks were opened, the cost of their maintenance began to be a sore point. Roosevelt was jolted by budget requests for almost $1 million in personal services, salaries, for the Long Island parks alone. Thinking of his national image, yet not aware that liberal public spending might be a way to cushion the effects of the Depression, the governor was anxious not to give opponents the chance to portray him as a big spender. By the end of 1930, moreover, state revenues had been so slashed by the Depression that the state budget was quiveringly taut. Throughout his second term, he was continually pressing his cabinet members to cut costs. There was constant friction over Moses' budget requests. But in these battles with the governor, Moses played the popularity that was his trump card for all it was worth. In fact, so sure was he, and he was right, that Roosevelt was afraid he would resign, that he began using the technique, when Roosevelt crossed him on major issues, of threatening to do so. Resignation threats begin appearing in Moses' letters to Roosevelt in the middle of 1930. By the end of that year, he had refined the wording. In November 1930, for example, Roosevelt slashed his budget requests for appropriations in the 1931 budget, and Moses wrote him, "If proposed cuts stand, I do not want any responsibility for the program." A similar threat had been strikingly ineffective when made to Ed Richards beside the swimming pool at Yale. But given the fact of his tremendous popularity, it was very effective now. Over the 4 years of Roosevelt's governorship, a pattern emerged. Moses would submit a budget request far higher than the previous years. Roosevelt would cut it back almost to the level of the previous request. Moses would tell Roosevelt he would have to resign if he didn't get the funds he wanted. Roosevelt, usually through an intermediary, would back away from the fight, restoring a substantial portion of the cut. The legislature was frantic. In 1928, Moses had assured them that the cost of the Ocean Parkway's initial 2-mile stretch would be $3,150,000. They had allocated the money, and in 1929, he showed up before them again. The $3,150,000 had been spent, he said, but he had neglected to tell them that the cost of paving the parkway would be extra, $850,000 extra. But they had been trapped. The hydraulic fill for the road had been dredged, the right-of-way graded, the surveying completed, the plans drawn. The $3,150,000 had been spent. Were they now to waste this money by refusing funds to complete the job? Cut as the legislators would, and they always cut, the amount of the annual allocation to the Long Island Park Commission rose steadily, from $3,150,000 in the last year of Smith's regime to $4 million in 1929, $4,700,000 in 1930, and $5,700,000 in 1931. By stake driving and whipsawing, Robert Moses was getting what he wanted from them. And the projects moved forward. In 1931, the Southern State Parkway was extended from Wantagh to Massapequa. In 1932, from Massapequa to Amityville. The public marveled at the fact that there was a route clear across Nassau County without a single traffic light or intersection. Park facilities were constantly being expanded. A new bathhouse, chlorination plant, and playground were built at Valley Stream State Park. 10 tennis courts, a miniature golf links, and a bridle path at Hempstead Lake, a whole new bathing beach and a spacious stone bathhouse at Heckscher, a causeway to open up new portions of the beach at Sunken Meadow, a loop drive at Montauk Point. And the picnic tables, campfire sites, and acres of new parking fields mounted by the hundreds. Some measure of the scope of Moses' achievement is afforded by attendance figures. The number of visits to the Long Island State Parks approximated 3 million in 1930. The total number of visits to all national parks in the United States in that year was 3,400,000. More than not opposing such a program, a governor would want to be identified with it. Roosevelt was not present at the first two opening ceremonies Moses staged during his administration. The plaque unveiling at Heckscher State Park, and a ribbon cutting on Southern State Parkway. The state representative was Lieutenant Governor Lehman, and at least one source says that the reason was that Moses, to teach Roosevelt a lesson, invited Lehman instead of him. But after a working relationship was evolved,